And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it's a cold January 12th. I had to go get a tire replaced. And it amazes me how many people have had tire problems since this cold front moved in. They were almost out of tires. Well, as I said, today is January the 12th, 12th day of the year. 353 days remain till the end of the year. On this date in history, in 475, Byzantine Emperor Zeno is forced to flee his capital at Constantinople, and his general Basilius gains control of the empire, which just goes to show you can't trust anybody. 1528, Gustav I of Sweden is crowned King of Sweden. Now, he'd already been in charge since his election in June of 1523, so it just took him a while to get around to making him king. 1554, Bien Nong, who was going to assemble the largest empire in the history of Southeast Asia, is crowned King of Burma. 1616, city of Belém, Brazil, is founded on the Amazon River Delta. It was founded by Portuguese captain Francisco Caldeira Castelo Branco. Been on the Amazon River, but I haven't been to Belém. 1808, John Rennie's scheme to defend St. Mary's Church, Recouvre, founded in 669, from coastal erosion is abandoned in favor of just tearing the damn thing down, despite the church being an exemplar of Anglo-Saxon architecture and sculpture. There are some folks that just take the shortcut. 1808, the organizational meeting leading to the creation of the Wernerian Natural History Society, a former Scottish Learned Society, is held in Edinburgh. 1848, the Palermo Rising takes place in Sicily. It was against the Bourbon Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. 1866, the Bourbons, of course, as I'm sure you know from history, were French-based. 1866, the Royal Aeronautical Society is formed in London. 1872, Johannes IV is crowned Emperor of Ethiopia in Axum. First imperial coronation in that city in over 200 years. 1895, the National Trust is founded in the United Kingdom. Now, the National Trust, for those that aren't familiar with it, is a charity and membership organization for heritage conservation in England, Wales, and Northern Ireland. And Scotland has a separate and independent National Trust for Scotland. It's a lot of the old manor houses were bought up by the National Trust rather than fall into disrepair. The one I really liked and would love to have had was known as Ashby St. Ledger. The Guy Fawkes plot was planned in the gatehouse of that manor house. It's a beautiful place. 1911, University of the Philippines, College of Law is formally established. Three future Philippine presidents are among the first enrollees. 1915, the U.S. House of Representatives rejects a proposal to require states to give women the right to vote. 1916, both Oswald Belki and Max Immelmann, for achieving 8 aerial victories each over Allied aircraft to get the German Empire's highest military award, the Prix de Mérite, as the first German aviators to actually earn it. Immelmann came up with the famous Immelmann turn, which is basically a reverse loop-de-loop. 1918, the Mini-Pit disaster coal mining accident occurs in Halmer End in Staffordshire. 155 men and boys die. 1932, Hattie Carraway becomes the first woman elected to the U.S. Senate. 1942, World War II. Roosevelt creates the National War Labor Board. 1945, the Red Army begins the Vistula Oder Offensive. 1962, Operation Chopper. First American combat mission in the war takes place on this date. 1964, rebels in Zanzibar begin a revolt known as the Zanzibar Revolution and proclaim a republic. 1966, Lyndon Johnson states the U.S. should stay in South Vietnam till communist aggression there is ended. Yeah, he said a lot of things. 1967, Dr. James Bedford becomes the first person to be chironically preserved with the intent of future resuscitation. 1969, New York Jets of the American Football League defeat the Baltimore Colts of the National Football League to win Super Bowl III in what's considered one of the greatest upsets in sports history. 1970, Biafra capitulates, ending the Nigerian Civil War. 1971, the Harrisburg Seven. Reverend Philip Berrigan and five other activists are indicted on charges of conspiring to kidnap Henry Kissinger and of plotting to blow up the heating tunnels of federal buildings in Washington, D.C. Kidnapping Henry Kissinger, based upon some of the things Kissinger said and done, might have been considered a positive thing. 1976, the United Nations Security Council votes 11-1 to allow the Palestine Liberation Organization to participate in a Security Council debate, but they weren't to have any voting rights. 1986, the Space Shuttle Program. Congressman Bill Nelson lifts off from Kennedy Space Center aboard Columbia on mission STS-61C. He was a payload specialist. Now that is a brilliant idea, launching these Congress people into orbit. 1990, seven-day pogrom breaks out against the Armenian civilian population of Baku, Azerbaijan, during which Armenians were beaten, tortured, murdered, and expelled from the city. 1991, Persian Gulf War. An act of the U.S. Congress authorized the use of American military forces to drive Iraq out of Kuwait, even though it was the statements of our Iraqi ambassador that led to them going into Kuwait. 1998, 19 European nations agree to forbid human cloning. Yeah, there are certain people we don't need more than one of. 2001, Downtown Disney opens to the public as part of the Disneyland Resort in Anaheim, California. 2004, the world's largest ocean liner, RMS Queen Mary II, makes its maiden voyage. 2005, Deep Impact launches from Cape Canaveral on a Delta II rocket. Now, Deep Impact was a NASA space probe designed to study the interior composition of the comet Tempel 1, by releasing an impactor into the comet. At 5:52 UTC on July 4, 2005, the impactor successfully collided with the comet's nucleus. The impact excavated debris from the interior of the nucleus, forming an impact crater. And photographs taken show the comet to be more dusty and icy, and less icy than had been expected. So basically, we spend a whole lot of money to build to dig a hole. Typical. 2006, a stampede during the stoning of the devil ritual on the last day of the Hajj in Mina, Saudi Arabia, kills at least 362 Muslim pilgrims. 2010, an earthquake in Haiti occurs, kills between 220,000 and 300,000 people, destroys a large part of the capital, Port-au-Prince. 2012, violent protests occur in Bucharest, Romania, as two-day-old demonstrations continue against President Traian Băsescu's economic austerity measures. Clashes are reported in numerous Romanian cities between protesters and law enforcement. 2015, government raids kill 143 Boko Haram fighters in Kolofata, Cameroon. 2016, 10 people are killed and 15 wounded in a bombing near the Blue Mosque in Istanbul. And in 2020, Taal volcano in the Philippines erupts, kills 39 people. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Christian Feast Day, Alaret of Revolts, Benedict Biscop, Bernardo Corleone, Marguerite Bourgeois, Tatiana, earliest day on which Lee Jackson Day can fall, January 18th is the latest, celebrated on the Friday before Martin Luther King Day in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and Turkmenistan, it's Memorial Day, in India, it's National Youth Day, in Russia, it's Prosecutor General's Day, and in Tanzania, the Zanzibar Revolution Day. We got some interesting things that we celebrate. Let's see what else we got on this date in history. 1493 on this date is the last day for all Jews to leave Sicily. 1528, Gustav I of Sweden, crowning the King of Sweden, rules for 37 years, becomes known as the father of the nation. 1598, Pope Clement VIII seizes the Duchy of Ferrara on the death of Alfonso.
Motion detected at the front door.
I talked about the city of Belém. That's known as the entrance gate to the Amazon. In 1773, the first public museum was established in North American colonies. It's in Charlestown, South Carolina. Or Charleston, as it's pronounced usually. 1777, the Mission Santa Clara de Assis, founded in California. 1803, the Senate approves Thomas Jefferson's nominations of James Monroe and Robert Livingstone to negotiate the purchase of New Orleans from France. I wonder if it's too late to give it back. 1806, French evacuate Vienna. 1807, gunpowder ship explodes in Leiden, Netherlands, kills 150 people. 1812, the first cargo arrives in New Orleans by steam. It came from Natchez, Mississippi. 1816, France decrees that the Bonaparte family is excluded from the country forever. I see a repeat of that. 1836, on this date, the HMS Beagle, with Charles Darwin on board, reaches Sydney, Australia. 1861, Florida state troops demand the surrender of Fort Pickens. 1863, on this date, President Davis delivers his State of the Confederacy address. 1865, the Union fleet bombs Fort Fisher in North Carolina. 1875, Quang Tsu becomes Emperor of China. 1896, the first X-ray is done in the U.S. It was done by Dr. Henry Smith in Davidson, North Carolina. 1900, on this date, the Freeland Colony is founded in the U.S. 1902, the Utah-Vala Suffrage Association is formally dissolved. That was an organization dedicated to getting women the right to vote. 1906 is the first time the Dow Jones closes above 100. It was 100.26. 1908, a long-distance radio message is sent from the Eiffel Tower for the very first time. 1913, after using pseudonyms over the years, Joseph Dugashvili signs himself as Stalin, which means man of steel, in a letter to the newspaper Social Democrat. 1916, the Brits proclaimed the Gilbert and Ellice Islands in the Pacific as a colony. 1929, what's known as C train service begins between New Orleans and Havana. That is when you put railroad cars on board ships. 1939, what was known as Timely Comics, later called Marvel, was founded by American publisher Martin Goodman in New York. Probably the best known artist and Marvel creative leader was Stan Lee, who I had the opportunity to meet several times before his death. 1942, Dutch troops on Tarakan surrendered to the Japanese. 1943, Frankfurters replaced by Victory Sausages. 1944, there was a failed resistance raid on the distribution office of Burgerstraat in Amsterdam. 1945, German forces in Belgium retreat in the Battle of the Bulge. 1945, in the Battle of South China Sea, the U.S. Task Force 38 destroys 41 Japanese ships. 1948, Mahatma Gandhi begins his final fast. 1949, Arthur Godfrey and his friends premieres on CBS TV. I remember my grandmother watching that. 1949, Dutch court affirms the death sentence against SS Chief Hans Rauter. 1950, the Swedish tanker rams the British submarine Trusulant in the Thames. 64 people die. 1952, the University of Tennessee admits its first black student. 1956, the FBI arrests six members of the Great Brinks robbery gang 6 days before the statute of limitations on the crime ran out. 1957, the Southern Christian Leadership Council, founded with Martin Luther King Jr. as leader, was formed at the Ebenezer Church in Atlanta. 1959, the American record company Motown is founded by Berry Gordy as Tamla Records. 1962, Operation Ranch Hand begins, a U.S. Air Force operation to spray South Vietnamese forests with defoliant such as Agent Orange, which causes a lot of medical problems. 1964, a revolution overthrows the Sultan of Zanzibar 1 month after independence. 1966, Batman, starring Adam West as Batman, Burt Ward as Robin, and Cesar Romero as the Joker, debuts on ABC. I never missed that show. 1967, the Louisville, Kentucky Draft Board refuses to give an exemption to boxer Muhammad Ali. At that time, he was Cassius Clay. Changed his name to Muhammad Ali and became a religious man. In 1967, NBC premieres the colorized remake of Dragnet. Well, I think we have come to the end of our history session. We've been talking about all kinds of strange things. Yesterday we were talking about the occult and its involvement with the Battle of Britain, where British witches and warlocks came together to defeat the invasion plans. And after nearly defeating the Allied powers in World War I, Germany's subsequent loss in that war propelled the country into a state of economic and political ruin. According to experts on the occult, it was clearly the spiritual ruin that pushed that once world-leading, culturally refined nation to the brink of complete annihilation in World War II. They frankly believe Germany became possessed. Led by a madman who some claim was demon-possessed himself, the Nazi Party first bullied its way into German's political stage, and then, as it lifted by an evil wizard spell, began to dominate the social, political, cultural, and even spiritual values of the country. The black-uniformed SS and the fires it burned at the Reichstag seem more like costumes and plot lines pulled from low-budget horror movies than real life. The Nazi soldiers and party leaders appeared to be more like dark arts masters involved in occult rituals than any type of government agency. But the question still remains, were the dark arts really involved? Now, it's a controversial subject, even among the most rabid historians. But it's not an argument about whether the occult influenced Nazism at all. Historians may argue about the extent of the occult, but most acknowledge that dark aspect of the occult infected the Nazi elite. And then you have to ask, did this quest for magical power have any effect on Germany's successes and failures during the war? Now, the Nazi Party itself could be seen as the bastard child of several occult movements that came into vogue during the years between the World Wars. While critics often dismiss allegations of the party's occult ties as being overdone and merely reflective of German society at large, it's difficult to imagine that the Nazi Party could have formed and gained power without help and guidance from certain Germanic occult groups, especially the Thule Society. It's also difficult to imagine the Nazis not usurping the membership of these societies when it served their purposes, since they clearly resonated with much of their ideology. Now, whether the Nazi Party grew as an extension of occult groups can be debated. What can't be debated is the extent to which these groups spread in the days after World War I and before the takeover by the Nazis. Several leading members of the Nazi Party before Hitler's takeover in the 30s were involved at various levels within groups such as the Thule Society. The occult group traces its origin to a disgruntled World War I veteran. Walter Nauhaus began the organization as a study group, and it's probably no coincidence that the belief system he began to construct would interest leaders of the burgeoning Nazi movement. After all, both Nauhaus and the party's future leader, Adolf Hitler, were World War I vets, anti-Semitic, art students, and very bitter about what had happened. Some Hitler biographers actually claim Hitler joined the Thule Society. Others swear there isn't any proof of that. Most historians admit that leading party members, Rudolf Hess and Hans Frank, were definitely members, while other Nazis may have had a more informal tie with the group, such as brief speaking appearances at the group's meetings. Still, the Society's basic occult teachings must have served some purpose for the Nazis. Society members believed in a divine origin of the Aryan race, as did the Nazi Third Reich. The deep and strident anti-Semitism of the Society's mythology, which portrayed the Aryans as a people betrayed by Jews, lent itself well to the propaganda put forth by Hitler and his nationalistic movement. They were seeking a scapegoat for Germany's loss in the war and its dire economic conditions. Now, Thule was the name that ancient Roman and Greek geographers used when they referred to the northern edges of the known world. In today's world, we call it Scandinavia. But for the society's members, Thule had a magical origin. They believed that Thule was an island or landmass near Greenland or Iceland, the original home of the Aryan race. Members also believed that Plato's tale about Atlantis actually referred to Thule. Members must have seen the rise of Hitler and his ambitions for a Third Reich as a way to reanimate the lost kingdom of Thule. Now, for those that are not familiar with the term, Reich actually means empire. And this would be the Third Empire. German Empire, that is. The Thule Society wasn't the only occult group active before Hitler's ascent. Some historians who've studied the Nazis' occult activity say that a secret group espousing racial superiority and wielding magic power was pulling the strings of German society, leading that country ever closer to worldwide conflagration. But, like every occult Nazi mystery, the Vril Society, as the group is often called, is still cloaked in layers of secrecy and fraud, wrapped in tentacles of suspicion and paranoia. In fact, that society could be nothing more than a plot twist from a work of fiction called Vril, The Power of the Coming Race, by Edward Bulwer Lytton. According to this book, a master race lives inside the earth and has learned how to use a mysterious force called Vril. The force gives them awesome powers to heal, as well as equally astonishing powers to kill and destroy. As an allegory, the tale of the Vril Yah, or the people who possess the power of Vril, certainly sounds like the Nazi movement, which started in substrata of society among the outcasts and rejects of the class-conscious German culture. There was, and seemingly still is, a group of occultists who believed that this novel was a true account, not a work of fiction. They firmly believe in the Vril Yah, their power, and a group of humans who somehow established contact with these subterranean overlords. The story of the Vril wasn't just a folk legend passed down in German villages. Some of the Vril believers were among the biggest names in the occult world at that time. People like Helena Blavatsky, founder of the Theosophy Society, and Rudolf Steiner, an occult leader, later find himself and his alleged magical powers in the sights of Nazi magicians. The hard pieces of proof that believers of the Vril Nazi connection offer, the unmatched success of German forces early in the war, and their uncanny secret weapons programs. Without Vril, the Germans would never have defeated their enemies in Poland and France, and at least early in the war, the Russian. There are even those who suggest the Nazi movement reached its military peak because they found a way to tap into some Vril power and technology. Jet-powered weapons and missiles were developed and perfected by the Nazis long before Allied forces could get their hands on that technology. The notion of Vril also touches on something else that will be discussed, Foo Fighters. Some people believe that the strange orbs that harassed and buzzed Allied fighter planes and bombers weren't flying ships from another planet, but secret weapons developed by German engineers and magicians and fueled by Vril power. But critics of this theory have one question that no one can answer. With all this power at their disposal, why did the Nazis lose the war? And the answer to that, many say, is very simple. Vril power and all the other powers the Nazis tried to tap into just wasn't as powerful as the magical forces the Allies arrayed against Germany, especially the coming together of warlocks and witches and other practitioners of the magical arts in the occult Battle of Britain that we talked about yesterday. Well, one name that is well known to a lot of folks who look at the strange and the unusual is Charles Fort. He died in 1932, just as the winds of World War II began to kick up in the cities of Europe and the islands of the Pacific. He spent a lifetime studying phenomena that drifted into the fringes of reality. Everything from stories of storms of frogs dropping from the sky to weird airships buzzing through the skies in the pre-aircraft era. Even today, his books, including Low and The Book of the Damned, are considered required reading by occultists and those interested in the supernatural. And his legacy is that he dared to study strange phenomena and explore the meaning behind it, rather than just write about it. Had he lived to see World War II, there's no doubt his list of anomalous phenomena would have grown exponentially. Let's look at some of the events and activities that would have tickled a man like Charles Fort. You know, World War II added another dimension to warfare, a third dimension, if you will. Although balloons and planes have been used in other conflicts, air power came of age during World War II. Paranormally speaking, the action went on the ground either, and witnesses, to include well-trained pilots, suggest the phenomena they experienced during the war came not just from the third dimension, but from dimensions beyond time and space. Fighter and bomber pilots who flew missions over Europe claimed that strange glowing objects with unmatched speed and agility followed and harassed them, and sometimes even mounted attacks on their formations. The pilots refer to these things as Foo Fighters. You and I might call them UFOs. And we're going to discuss that. Now, not all the Foo Fighters were in Europe. What's been referred to as the Battle of Los Angeles, which I've written extensively on, the west coast of the U.S. may have witnessed the only battle between armed to the teeth forces of humanity versus a craft or crafts piloted by extraterrestrial intelligence. VTs came in peace during World War II. The anti-aircraft gun-wielding Welcome Committee may have convinced them to leave quickly. In late autumn of 1944, American pilots knitted into formations of bombers and fighters swarmed the skies above Germany. And they were always on high alert. Rogue German fighters would pounce on airplanes the second they let their guard down. Flak guns would blast metal shells their way at any moment. But what caught them completely off guard were these new mysterious presences that made itself known in the skies above Europe at the end of 1944. The pilots and the crews of these planes watched, mystified, as strange blobs of light, often yellow or orange, shot into the air and darted through the sky. The objects often moved toward the formation. Thinking that enemy planes had them in their sights, pilots began evasive maneuvers and gunners stood by ready for the inevitable conflict. When the lights closed in, though, the crews were stunned that these craft didn't look at all like any other aircraft in the enemy's arsenal with which they were familiar. They climbed at speeds beyond the acceleration of any aircraft at that time, darted through the formation in ways that could create G-forces strong enough to tear a human body apart. Crews quickly dubbed the flying things Foo Fighters, possibly after a comic strip catchphrase. They also used the less politically correct Kraut Fireballs. Now, while current UFO theorists quickly jumped into an extraterrestrial explanation, it's important to note that the Allied air crews and did not immediately entertain the idea these objects were piloted by extraterrestrial entities. They believed they were facing a new German secret weapon. Throughout the war, in veiled messages and threats, Hitler insinuated that German scientists were about to unleash scores of secret weapons on the Allies. And with V-2 rockets and jet planes scorching through the skies, the pilots are ready to believe that the Foo Fighters were a new phase in Germany's plan to win the war with secret weapons. Well, if that was the case, the weapon didn't seem to go on the attack. They seemed more interested in observing and toying with American bombers and fighters. They didn't really seem to concentrate on destroying them. U.S. Army Major William Leet reported on one such Foo Fighter encounter. That's according to Mac Maloney, a historian of wartime UFO sightings. In his book, UFOs in Wartime, What They Didn't Want You to Know, he wrote that Leet was piling up his B-17, called the Old Crow. It's interesting to note that most pilots actually had names for their planes. This was in December 1944, and he's flying over Austria. He's flying alone, taking part in a lone wolf mission, as he referred to it. These missions were meant to surprise and frustrate the German air defense and air force crews who were used to massive Allied bombing raids with dozens of bombers. Leet made visual contact with a strange object as he and his crew began to leave the airspace over Austria. He said the craft was a perfectly circular glowing amber light and estimated its size to be about 10 feet in diameter. Oddly, he claimed that he had just looked at that piece of airspace seconds before and it was empty. And the next time he looked back, there was this light. The pilot, who had numerous missions and hundreds of hours of flying time under his belt, never saw the Germans fly anything like it. And he definitely knew the Allied forces didn't have access to any such craft. Screw was convinced it was an attacking German aircraft and wanted to shoot at it. But Lee was convinced that, first, it wasn't a Nazi fighter, and second, because it wasn't demonstrating any form of hostile intentions, the strange thing wasn't a threat to him at all. He commanded his crew to not fire on the craft. He said the craft remained peacefully content to fly with his B-17 for a long portion of the flight back to base. And this gave him a long time to observe and study his strange escort. One thing he noticed was the object didn't change. Its speed, course, and luminosity were steady. And that seemed to reinforce his initial observation. This was an intelligently controlled craft of some sort. A meteor would have changed size and shape as well as quickly to lose some of its shine going through the Earth's atmosphere. A planet would have seemed to change direction as the plane changed course, but this object followed the bombers that zeroed in on its home base. Whether that intelligence was human or inhuman was a question that haunted Leet during the mission. He noticed a lack of exhaust. No man-made craft could have kept up that speed without producing some type of exhaust. Over time, he became convinced this wasn't a German wonder weapon and it wasn't something of this world as far as he was concerned. Now, that idea was reinforced when the crew lost contact with their impromptu escort. Leet said it didn't bank or turn away, it didn't increase speed, didn't change altitude, didn't slow down. It just vanished as suddenly as it appeared. When Leet and his crew landed, they reported the incident to the intelligence officer assigned to the squadron. The officer had a few suggestions for what the crew witnessed, but although the crew of the Old Crow never fired a shot at the object, they quickly and efficiently shot down all the theories that the intelligence officer raised. When the intelligence officer told Leet it was a German fighter, the pilot responded the fighter never took hostile action against his crew. That'd be kind of an odd strategy for a super-secret fighter plane not to take on a completely vulnerable bomber. When the officer guessed it was a spotter for German anti-aircraft gunners, Leet said during most of the mission, the plane was far from any anti-aircraft batteries. That put an end to that theory. With no other squadron tangled with Foo fighters quite like the pilots of the 415th Night Fighter Squadron, some experts suggest these pilots were actually the ones that dubbed the strange craft they witnessed Foo Fighters, although we really don't know for sure. What makes their reports even more credible is that only special pilots could make it into that unit. Keen eyesight and outstanding skill of observation were needed. In other words, these weren't the type of people to mistake the planet Venus for a hovering extraterrestrial mothership. They're also among the bravest pilots in the force composed of brave pilots to fly off in the night, completely vulnerable to German pilots and aircraft gunners. On the night of November 26, 1944, these skills were put to the test in ways one veteran night fighter crew member of the 415th would never have imagined. One crew jumped in their British-built Bristol Blue fighter, a multi-seat fighter, and cruised down to the 415th's base in France, searching for German trains that might be delivering ammunition and supplies to the troops. After destroying a few of those trains, the pilots noticed a red light appear and then track alongside his aircraft. The light came as close as a half mile away from his plane before it vanished. Now, it didn't seem like a big deal. The pilot mentioned the sighting in his debriefing mission, but that seemed to end it. Foo Fighter, however, wasn't done with the 415th. A veteran of the squadron, Lieutenant Donald Myers, later reported that pilots encountered more than one group of these Foo Fighters. He said there were red fireballs that would fly at the tips of the plane's wing. Three balls of Foo Fighters appeared in a vertical row and flew in front of the planes. Another group of Foo Fighters, about 15 of them, hovered in the distance. And sometimes these lights flickered on and off. With the Christmas holiday approaching, the pilot couldn't help but remark that the whole scene looked like a Christmas tree all decorated for the season. Myers, though, said at least one Foo Fighter wasn't in the Christmas spirit and chased his plane. He told a reporter he was cruising down the Rhine Valley at about 700 feet when he noticed two strange fireballs flying with him. Not sure what they were and presuming a defensive posture, he tried to outmaneuver the Foo Fighters, but he couldn't do it. He banked to the left. They turned with him. Banked to the right. They went to the right as well. We're doing 260 miles an hour, he said, and the balls are keeping right up with us. Some UFO historians say that radar operators, not the pilots, may be the ones who initially called these odd aerial phenomena they witnessed, the Foo Fighters. While the debate on who gets credit for the nickname continues, radar operators at the time did receive odd returns on their scopes and saw strange activity on their screens. In some cases, this phenomena coordinated with the pilots of the 415th were witnessing. During the December incident, for example, radar operators saw blips on their screen that corresponded to the pilots' eyewitness encounters with the Foo Fighters. Another radar operator for an anti-aircraft battalion, Andrew Armrose, reported that Foo Fighters were a somewhat common occurrence. Radar operators called these incidents ghost. Armrose said, I'd frequently picked up a target on the radar screen that appeared to be a conventional aircraft, but upon being tracked, it would accelerate to a fantastic speed, which made it impossible to set a rate on and even more difficult to identify. So we referred to him as Ghost. I've always been puzzled by the occurrence of these sightings I've personally made on radar. And it wasn't just pilots and crews of outlet aircraft that saw Foo Fighters. An American journalist who was reporting on the Normandy landing said he witnessed a strange craft in the sky above the invasion site, a craft he struggled to identify, let alone explain. According to George Tott, a reporter for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, he was on Omaha Beach one evening. The troops he was covering for the paper were about to break out of the beach and take on German forces in the interior of France. While walking on the beach, he looked up and noticed a pulsating red fireball in the sky. It was cruising overhead. He estimated the altitude of that rocket or the aircraft or whatever it was about a half mile up. The light, several times larger than any star in the sky that night, glided effortlessly overhead. He began to speculate about what it might be. First guess was that it was a new German weapon the Allied forces called a buzz bomb. The rocket-powered V-1s had started to fly out of German bases and into England just a few weeks before this sighting. But there was a problem with that speculation, and he was aware of it. This object was flying into German lines, not away from them. In England, the V-1s flew the exact opposite direction that this strange aircraft was flying. And just the way the craft maneuvered inside made the group of soldiers, including some high-ranking officers, arrive at the conclusion it was definitely not a buzz bomb. The object moved over the beach and then halted directly above the German-American lines and hovered. Tott timed it. It remained there for about 17 minutes. Then it flew away. Maybe most of the witnesses to this Normandy incident never heard the expression Foo Fighters. It was a relatively new phenomenon, after all. But they did realize they witnessed something strange and unexplainable that night, something most Freudian experts now place in the category of a World War II Foo Fighter. And it wasn't just in the European theater. Okay, I probably block 15 numbers a day of people who call and try to sell me everything from car warranties to don't I want to donate to the individuals who had medical problems or mental problems or some other problem. I donate a lot, but I only donate locally, and I can't seem to get that point across to them. So I just block the numbers, and they come up with another number. All right, we were talking about Foo Fighters over the Pacific. And while most of the documented Foo Fighter engagements were reported by Allied crews over the battlefields of Europe, many pilots saw similar things in the Pacific. According to the December 1945 issue of VFW magazine, B-29 crews had several run-ins with crafts that closely matched what their colleagues were encountering in Europe. These fireballs followed the bombers so closely that some witnesses said the objects almost sat on the pilots' tails. They changed colors, flashed from orange to red to white, and they repeated that cycle. With tales of devastating kamikaze attacks not far in the back of their minds, pilots initially thought these strange aircraft were these Japanese suicide pilots. But just as the sightings in Europe prompted no attacks, the Foo Fighters are strangely passive with the massive bombers on attack runs to Japan. During one of the disturbing encounter, the Foo Fighter chased an American B-29, one of the super fortresses that was delivering punishing bomb loads to Japan, into a cloud bank. Visibility was near zero in the cloud, and the pilot believed there'd be no way that strange aircraft could predict his evasive maneuvers. He knew his plane to be nearly invisible. But when he pulled his bomber up out of the clouds, the Foo Fighter was right there, matching his twists and turns with impeccable precision. So close, after about 500 yards away, the pilot could better describe the Foo Fighter than most of the others who had contact with him. So it was about 3 feet in diameter, wrapped in a phosphorescent red and orange glow. Didn't see a wing or a tail or a rudder that would suggest a conventional airframe. It was either a plane or a missile, which was his point of reference in those days. Just like in the encounters of other crews who claimed to have seen Foo Fighters, this object mysteriously vanished. The crew of the B-29 said as they approached the target, and as the sunlight began to appear, the Foo Fighter suddenly just vanished. The magazine reports on one more Foo Fighter sighting in the Pacific. B-24 Liberator crew saw one as it cruised high above Truk Lagoon, a once formidable Japanese naval base in the Caroline Islands. According to this crew's report, they were flying about 11,000 feet over Truk Lagoon when he noticed two red glowing balls of light rise into the air and head toward him, and it was closing in fast. During the flight, the orbs kept in close contact with the Liberator. One twisted around and returned to base, or wherever it came from, according to the crew. The other light stayed close to their plane, though. Sometimes just right beside the plane, sometimes slightly behind. Other times, the light swung in front of the bomber, obviously not afraid it would lose contact with the plane. Eventually, soon after daybreak, the light soared up a few thousand feet and vanished. The bomber crew radioed a nearby radar installation to get an assessment of any aircraft in the area, and they were told there were no enemy planes in the area at all. So what were the Foo Fighters, and why did they seem so keen to keep a close eye on Allied aircraft? In 1944, the answer seemed to be unanimous. They were German secret weapons. May have been remotely controlled machines, according to some speculation. German scientists and engineers made great progress in building remote-controlled aircraft. The lack of offensive capability seemed to cause doubt in many cases, though. Why build a remote-controlled airplane to just safely tag along behind an Allied formation? And then there was the matter of the performance of these craft. Nearly all the reports about Foo Fighters include details that are hard to explain through the performance of known aircraft at the time. Crafts are said to make instant stops and hover, attain great speeds, instantly disappear, match the quick turns and dives of top-of-the-line fighter planes with ease. Another theory is that the Germans created Foo Fighters as a secret weapon, that the aim of the weapon was psychological. They were just remote-controlled planes designed to scare the pilots, according to this theory. Now, if it's true, no documents on such a project have turned up in exhaustive searching and cataloging of Nazi military weapons. Nor did Nazi officers reveal the existence of such a plan during equally exhaustive interrogations. One would think that after decades of searching the same files and hearing the same testimonies that reveal the most closely held secrets of the German war machine, like the V-2, would also uncover the Foo Fighter secret. The military eventually decided that Foo Fighters were natural phenomena, either ball lightning or perhaps, say, an Elmo's fire. The problem with both of these theories is that the phenomena in question are both rare and short-lived. It's doubtful, for instance, that ball lightning is going to tag along with a B-17 for over 40 minutes. And they aren't known to create radar signatures either. And although the military wanted to pass the buck and suggest more natural explanation for Foo Fighters, an inconvenient fact came up at that point. The quality of the observers who witnessed Foo Fighters and the exacting detail of their observations reported to control flight, not natural phenomena. After all, there are no better observers of aerial phenomena than pilots. And there's no better time for trained observers than during World War II. These are pilots who could see a mere dot on the horizon and tell you the aircraft's make and model, and whether it was hostile as well. Their lives and the lives of their crew depended on such keen powers of observation. And at no time in history were more pilots, trained observers, I might add, in the skies than during World War II. And pilots during World War II spent an unusual amount of time in the sky and witnessed a range of aerial phenomena, from meteorites to strange electromagnetic and weather-related phenomena. They knew the difference between a bolt of lightning or a streak working meteorite and an intelligently piloted craft, in other words. Fact is mentioned, in some cases, the sightings lasted for a relatively long time. It defies the imagination that a pilot could spot an enemy fighter and prepare a countermaneuver in seconds, couldn't spot signs of a conventional aircraft or natural aerial phenomenon when they had observed the object for almost an hour. Although there's still debates going on, the Foo Fighter remains one of World War II's most enduring mysteries. And we mentioned earlier the Battle of Los Angeles. It's not overly well known, but from late February 24 to the early morning of February 25, 1942, the city of Los Angeles, California, was startled awake by explosive flashes and the sweeping beams of spotlights frantically scanning the sky. Now, these weren't popping flash bulbs and swinging spotlights announcing the latest movie premiere. This was war, and the city apparently was under attack. Historians mostly blame the bizarre events now known as the Battle of Los Angeles or the Great Los Angeles Air Raid simply on a lethal combination of war jitters. Pearl Harbor, after all, had happened just a few months before, mixed with mistaken identity. In fact, this event's been satirized and ridiculed. Steven Spielberg directed the comedy in 1941, starring John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, which was inspired by that night's events. The movie suggested that the people of L.A. may have let Hollywood's zeal for war movies cloud their judgment about actual war. And after the war, the Japanese, when questioned, revealed that there were no aircraft, at least none they sent, over L.A. that night. And war records seem to corroborate that Spielberg's version of the air raid was much closer to reality than we might have guessed. But, in spite of that, there's another side to this. Many witnesses, while discounting a Japanese attack or any kind of conventional enemy aircraft in the sky, still believe there was actually something in the sky that night over the L.A. These are credible, sober witnesses. They don't seem to be the type of people who'd be swept up in war jitters, as the War Department called it. And they say the object they saw was far more disconcerting than even a fleet of marauding enemy aircraft. The late C. Scott Littleton, a professor of anthropology at Occidental College in L.A., was one of those witnesses. And even though he wasn't a ufologist, he believes he saw that night something more than a stray blimp or a misidentified warplane. According to his story, he was just a child living with his parents and extended family in a home near Hermosa Beach, California. He was awoken by the blast of anti-aircraft fire. Looked out the window and could see the flashes of anti-aircraft gunfire and the frantic scanning of searchlight beams. Now, initially, he said the activity didn't scare him. Gunners routinely practiced on targets towed behind aircraft. He had seen it several times. But something about the ferocity of the barrage and the confusion of the searchlight, as well as the timing, raised questions in his mind. Most of the night's exercises are early in the evening so that resident sleep wouldn't be disturbed. Littleton became concerned, and soon enough, the rest of his family began to feel the same way. His father, a neighborhood air raid warden, had received no alerts about a drill and frantically tried to contact the authorities while huddling his family together and ordering him into the makeshift bomb shelter he had built in the basement. Littleton remembers listening to the sharp report of the guns raking the skies while he and his mother, along with his grandparents, talked nervously. It was Littleton's mother who actually took the first brave steps to investigate what was going on. She walked out of her makeshift bunker and walked down to the beach. Littleton followed, half afraid, his mother telling him to go back to the basement. Shrapnel was falling on the beach, and there was a roar of planes overhead. Littleton thought those planes might be the enemy aircraft. He found out later they were pursuit planes. But that was before he saw what the planes were pursuing. Looking out on the Pacific Ocean, he and his mother gasped as they watched an object floating above the sea. The spotlight zeroed in on a silvery, lozenge-shaped bug hanging in the night sky. No moon that night, so it was no mistaking the object for a celestial body. The one thing the witnesses immediately noticed was that the object stood nearly motionless. It hovered completely still, and they estimated it hung between 4,000 and 8,000 feet above the ocean. That ability to hover without making a sound was unlike anything Littleton had ever seen among the numerous military aircraft that practiced in that area. And the gunners are obviously looking at the same object. The explosions from the anti-aircraft shells concentrated on the silver object floating above the sea. Streams of spotlights had the object in their sights as well. fact, one famous photo shows pilots serenely poised in the crosshairs, showed the craft serenely poised in the crosshairs of several spotlight beams. Meanwhile, shrapnel from these shots began to rain down on the mother and son, who backed up to the house so the falling debris wouldn't hit them. Little also noticed one other odd thing. Despite the gunfire, the craft took neither defensive action to get out of harm's way or aggressive action against the gunners. And both certainly seemed to be within its capabilities. None of the rounds that appeared to land on or near the craft had any effect whatsoever. After taking a brutal fusillade from everything the American military could throw at it, the ship began to drift unscathed toward Redondo Beach. And the family noticed another strange activity that night. Right after the UFO disappeared and the gunfire stopped, they heard aircraft engine roaring overhead. They seemed to be following that floating craft. Littleton guessed the engine sounds were P-38s from a nearby airfield. He believed they were called out to give chase to the bizarre craft they had just seen. And other witnesses confirmed the Littleton's encounter. Artist and interior decorator, identified only as Katie, volunteered as an air raid warden for West L.A. She was sleeping in the early morning hours of February 25th when her air raid supervisor called and told her to be on the lookout for a plane flying very near her house. She went to the nearest window and looked out, saw exactly what her supervisor described, but it didn't look like anything that showed up on the enemy aircraft identification chart. She said it was huge. It was enormous. During the air raids, the authorities issued an order to turn out the lights, which had an unforeseen effect. An effect that UFO hunters in urban areas hardly ever experience. Los Angeles became deathly dark, offering unmatched vistas of the sky and the stars. And in the uncluttered sky, Katie could make out the details of that craft perfectly. It was a lovely pale orange and about the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. I could see it perfectly because it was very close, and it was big. She saw the sky searchlight beam zero in on the craft, which hovered in one spot for a long time, just as the Littletons described. She also saw other aircraft in the area, but noticed they turned around shortly before the barrage of anti-aircraft fire opened fire on the object. Next morning, those charged with the defense of L.A. issued a hastily written report on the incident. The report said it was definitely not the Japanese. And if you read between the lines, it was also not a spacecraft from another planet. The defense officials blamed the incident on normal war jitters, a balloon, and weather conditions. However, the eyewitnesses just didn't buy the official line. It remains one of World War II's most hotly debated incidents. Well, we've actually come to the end of this show. We've got a few more seconds. Tomorrow we're going to talk about something odd. The Philadelphia experiment and how that may actually tie into what you might refer to as Fortean forces. Until then, have a truly great evening. And this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying talk to you tomorrow.